This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 112. Today we speak with George Scipione about biblical counseling. Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we thank everyone who helps to make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/donate. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and we are excited today for episode number 112. Joining me on the panel is Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's good to be here.
We also have Nick Batzig, who is a church planter with the PCA just outside of Savannah, Georgia in Richmond Hill. How are you doing, Nick?
Very good, Camden. Good to be on. Obama is in Savannah, and I have chosen to be on with you all and talk with George today. So I'm glad to be on.
Well, thank you for turning down Mr. President to come visit with us. We're looking forward to this discussion. We have a very special guest today and a very interesting and engaging topic. Today we're speaking with Dr. George Scipione, who is adjunct professor of pastoral theology, as well as the director of the Biblical Counseling Institute at Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Scipione.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my honor to be here.
Well, we're very excited. We're going to be speaking about biblical counseling today and looking at difficult cases. And this is a subject that is very important. It's part of the pastor's job to counsel his people, to shepherd them. It's involved in our lives as Christians, trying to help and encourage one another. And it's also an area in which we have seen some controversy in terms of how we approach this subject and what counseling exactly is and the role of office and all sorts of different things that are involved in understanding a biblical counseling model. So we're going to be speaking about that today. I'll turn things over to you, Nick, if you'd like to introduce a little bit more about Dr. Scipione and talk about our subject and its importance in terms of being a pastor.
Sure. I had Dr. Scipione for my biblical counseling course at Greenville, and I know probably many of our listeners who went to Westminster, California, or RPTS, maybe even other schools, have had him. And very beneficial course. I wish that I had had years of biblical counseling, and especially now as I am in the pastorate, as you are, Jeff, and you know, you realize the things you don't learn in seminary and right. All the different cases and the variables. And I remember distinctly several of the case studies that we talked about, Dr. Scipione, and just being struck with the reality that these things were going to happen, that we were going to face very, very difficult situations, and listening to you tell some that happened in, you know, Reformed churches and OPC churches and churches that we think doctrinally have it all together, and yet which is some very extreme cases. And so I wanted to just open it up today and ask you if you would be willing to talk about a few of those things that you talk with your students about in class and give us some helpful guidelines how to approach things biblically but with the wisdom that we often lack. And would you be willing to open up with one or two of some of the more difficult cases that you've come across in your many years of pastoral ministry?
I'd be willing to do that. Boy, there's so many to pick from. Let me pick two of different sorts. One was a marriage situation, a couple who had difficulty. It was the second marriage for the one gentleman who was the husband and the wife. It was her first marriage. They had some stepchildren living with them, but things got so bad they went to be with the mother, and they had two children. There was a lot of, not a lot, but there was some physical violence, even on her part. They were not going to Reform Church. He had her exorcised several times to have demons cast out, etc., coming from more radical churches, put those in quotes, but a bad situation all told. Counseled them, for a period of time. They seemed to make some outward progress. 5 years later, they came back. Things were worse. Eventually, I said to them, look, there's no way that I can help you unless you are in a church that practices church discipline and has elders that really shepherd people.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to a Reformed church, and at my suggestion, you can come to the one that I'm co-pastor of, or you can go to this one. It's closer. So they chose to go there, and they were interviewed by the elders, and the elders said, well, we can't accept you as members. And they said, well, why not? He said, because we'd have to immediately put both of you under discipline, you know, because your lives are such rebellion, et cetera, et cetera. So long story short, they stuck around for a year, and the woman finally sitting under decent preaching and teaching knew that she wasn't demon-possessed. She had bad problems with sins that she needed to repent of. She began to be assured that she really did understand the gospel and that she was God's child and wanted to join. A year later, he refused to join. He didn't want to come under their leadership. He had connections with the militia movement, the common law movement, et cetera, and he tried to actually sue me in common law court, and I would not go anywhere near a jury of his peers because they were not my peers. and he was going to sue for alienation of affection, not that we were hitting on the wife, but we were telling her that he was in rebellion, et cetera. So eventually he sued for divorce in common law court, and even though the marriage was not salvaged, she was protected from abuse, and eventually with the children was granted by the church a legitimate grounds for biblical divorce, and you know, she's now at least safe from that kind of situation. Mm. And that has obviously many factors in it and details. I don't want to give any more details in case anyone recognizes the people, but the ecclesiology, the shepherding, all of that was necessary. Good teaching was necessary to correct very bad theology that had serious consequences. Bad theology often can.
Yeah.
As an adjunct to that, I have a case that I open up my intro course with. It's a case of a Korean pastor whose wife was supposedly demon-possessed, and they had a demon-ousting ritual where people stomped on her, et cetera, an evangelist, and she died. And it, ironically, this was years ago, was in California, and she died on July 4th, you know, our day of, you know, national freedom.
Mm.
And, of course, they ended up doing time for that. So your bad theology can lead to very serious consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. If you want another one, I ended up dealing with a woman, born a woman, who had desires to be a man, literally went through sex change operation, was legally declared a man, legally, you can put that in quotes, you know, man's law, mm-hmm. married a woman, and before I met this unquote couple, who when I met them were converted believers, reformed even. The gal was converted. The unquote man was converted. Wanted to go to an evangelical seminary to preach the gospel, not a reformed seminary. And someone on the panel interviewing her said, you know, this just really doesn't seem right. Now, just as an aside, this woman showed me a picture of her when she was in, quote, a man, a beard to kill for that I will never have that thick. But, you know, I would have never guessed in a million years that this was a woman. So it was actually a reformed pastor who, I won't name the guilty, but even some biblical counselors were consulted and they didn't know what to do. This was years ago, and basically a Reformed pastor, just a regular old pastor, said, look, God made you a woman. That's what you are. Part of repentance is being a woman, like it or not. So reassumed the identity, obviously, with all the literal physical scars, you know, on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And they got unmarried, you know, because they realized it was a farce. And you know, both of them were, well, the last that I knew, were trying to go abroad to do witnessing in a foreign country. So that's a complicated case that, you know, if it showed up at your church, not only would you have to figure out which bathroom to send the person to, you have all kinds of ethical implications.
Yeah.
So there are some of the kinds of things, one with abuse, et cetera, one with sexual confusion. These are things that you run into.
Now, of course, these are extraordinarily difficult situations, but as we look at them and try to arrive at them and approach them biblically, I wanted to ask you a few theological foundational questions. And you alluded to one in the first when you spoke about the role of ecclesiology. What is the importance of having a solid ecclesiology as we understand counseling? And specifically, I'm looking at the role of office. And oftentimes some people bring up the issue of every member ministry, which is claimed, is taught in Ephesians 4. And that often gets thrown around. But what is your position on counseling and the church and the role of and the gifting of officers?
Well, my answer is I think Ephesians 4 is a seminal passage. And I would claim that one of the forgotten omnes of the Protestant Reformation is the, you know, we talk about the solas, but we forget all peoples are prophet, priest, and king.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I think to say a person is a minister is a biblical misnomer. We are all ministers. Ordained officers have a functional role that cannot be replaced by a layperson, male or female. So, you know, I have a pretty tight view of office in that I don't think only ordained elders can do certain things, the word and sacrament,
mm-hmm.
not lay people of either sex or little kids that are 10 years old because the Boy Scout troop is having a, you know, taking over the service. That's biblically abominable, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
As my wife teaches me to say, my not so humble opinion, it is not appropriate. So, in the spectrum, here's a quick definition: if counseling is discipleship, then you obviously have to say that discipleship is something that goes beyond the ordained eldership.
Mm.
But if we are talking Matthew 18, sin that is kind of stubborn and not changing, then we're talking about the whole Matthew 18 process. And I would say once you get beyond the two or three others, you tell it to the church in Reformed or Presbyterian circles or even good independent circles, that would be the elders.
Yes.
So that at that point, you know, the shepherding rod comes out, and that can't be done by lay people. So I may be weird to most people, but I don't have any problems of a church hiring a woman to disciple women under the authority of the elders.
Right.
But once it gets to a position of this is a church discipline matter, then it is out of the hands of the woman or man who is not ordained, and then it goes into the sessional level and must be dealt with there.
I think that's a very helpful way to look at it. And some of the confusion comes up. You know, I'm a student at Westminster, and we're taught by many people at CCEF, and I have some theological differences with many of my friends there. And what they will present is a very broad view of counseling, and often there's a misunderstanding. In many ways, they'll say counseling is discipleship. But then in other contexts, we think about counseling as a professional endeavor or as the activity of what you're saying, a church discipline, those sorts of things. And even ministry of the word, the problem comes in. If you are making disciples, or if you are counseling someone and ministering the word to them, then questions of office arise there too, not just in disciplinary cases. That would be the positive or front side of discipline, though.
Sure, but having been there at almost the very beginning, mm-hmm. I mean, CCF started before I was there by a year or two, mm-hmm. but I was there back in the late 60s, and I think one of the things that I can say kindly about the brothers there is that we slightly differ, because the model that was started was really a professional model as opposed to a pastoral model, functionally. Jay was right, and of course, even in Jay's own writings, everybody kind of scratches their heads and says to me, I don't get it. Jay says everyone's competent to counsel, and then he says the pastor is God's professional, you know, right. Which is it? Well, I go, yes, because it's both. And, you know, parents disciple their children. There is one anothering. And I do think, to be honest, in reform circles, that can be watered down because we're so oriented toward the word and sacraments that I think we do at times forget the Reformation principles. But having said that, and living a day and age where everybody wants to be democratic, people don't believe in authority. And, you know, we don't all have equal authority. We all have equal dignity. But the wife is, you know, it's the Orthodox view of the Trinity. There's equality between the three persons, but there's functional economic subordination. Mm-hmm. And if you tweak that model, you no longer have the Trinitarian model of anything.
Right, right.
And, George.
And so that will affect this as well.
George, you raised another really interesting case that happened, a really sad case of a man that had molested kids in the congregation and then had repented and then needing to be restored. But the question then is, you know, where does he go to church? And, you know, God forbid that ever happens to our churches. It could happen. What advice would you have for pastors in churches if that ever happened? And you had someone that did something that horrible to the children of the church. Where would we go for that if there was a repentance?
Well, first of all, there's two issues. There's the sin issue. There's also the legal issue of criminality. Most states, we are mandated reporters, and I would argue that because we are to submit to the civil magistrate, except where it violates God's law,
right,
that we need to report, which means certainly that person has to face the consequences, even if they're repentant.
Right.
Guys will tell me, well, if he's repentant, I'm not going to report him. I don't think that that's biblically correct, ethically correct, and certainly legally. Most pastors, I know of cases, pastors who have gone to jail over those issues. Secondly, the elders have to determine how are we going to minister to these people. What if we have a registered sex offender? Now, in my counseling here, I've counseled someone who is a flasher, who exposes himself. He's had multiple convictions. He is, whether right or not, he's on the Megan's list. So it's publicly known of his conviction, even if he doesn't tell people. Well, he needs to inform the church so the church can make a wise decision in terms of how they're going to, A, let people know, protect themselves legally, etc. So there's many ramifications in an issue like that. The case that I think you might be mentioning is, it was an older man who was mild molest. I don't want to minimize anything, but we reported it to the police. The police chose not to, and Child Protective Services in California chose not to prosecute the case and push it. Huh. And, the father of the girl did not want this man to be around, understandably. But he was a member of the church. He was supposedly repentant. And we came up with a program where the deacons would actually not hound, but, you know, would shadow him wherever he would go. He wasn't allowed on the property except during worship services when he had to be there. The parents and everybody should just send him somewhere else. Well, he's still the same person. Are we going to say that that person like that cannot attend? No, but there are consequences to his sin. Mm. So the church needs to be advised. They need to have a plan of action. In that particular case,
I just wanted to say something. Actually, when I was a young man still living at home, that we had a scenario in my dad's church where he was pastor, where the youth worker was convicted of statutory rape of young men in the congregation. So I've seen it happen before my eyes. Sad scenario.
Right.
Well, that brings up the question. That brings up the question of responsibility in terms of the pastor and the elders. When you're counseling, if you were to just send somebody off and send somebody away, or if one of your counselees just decides to leave and go to another church, do you feel a responsibility to clue in the other church or to find out where that person might be attending in order to bring them up to speed on some of the counseling issues? Because we're in such a culture now where people just church hop, and because as a nation, the churches nowadays tend to have such a poor ecclesiology, people are able to church hop successfully.
Well, that's one of the reasons why discipleship, I think, is ordained, Matthew 28, it's in the church. That's why a freestanding counseling center that doesn't have church authority is a weak link.
Yeah.
And then my purpose is not to counsel everybody in Pittsburgh, but to train people. No, really, to train people to do it. It's also silly. That's one of the things philosophically, I believe it's a ministry of the word. We don't charge. If people want to donate to the seminary, fine. We did that in California. Sure, we have to scramble to put food on the table, but, I don't charge for evangelism or preaching. That's the church's job, to tithe and to give.
Right.
So the other thing is, if I'm paying my counselors, which I think they're worthy of their hire, then and I increase my counseling load, dude, I'm going in the hole, deeper. I'm just creating a big financial problem. That's why some people charge. They say, well, people won't really respect it, and that may be true, but I've got an easier way. You don't do what I ask you to do, then you're not welcome to come back until you're serious.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, there's other ways of doing it. But the ecclesiology, yes, we've had cases in Reformed churches where we've excommunicated someone and we've told sister churches, don't let the person in the door. They let the person in the door, and they do the same thing. So it's not just Calvary Chapels, that basically tell people to bug off, or independent churches and say, we'll take care of our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have connectional churches like OP, PCA, or United Reformed that basically say, inadvertently, we know better than you guys. And then the guy goes and rips off the other congregation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask if you had any advice for us as pastors in guarding against lawsuits. I know that you can be overly careful in this area, but it seems that oftentimes ministers are not really thinking about the fact that and sessions, talking about issues, discussing those issues. I think I heard one biblical counselor say he thought it was a good idea for members to fill out a sheet saying, we understand that some things that are very private in our lives may be discussed on the sessional level in order to keep them from getting sued, because churches get sued for millions of dollars because the session has to talk about issues. The pastor has to talk to his elders. Do you have any advice in that area for us?
Yeah, first of all, I think you would have a policy, and you can access some information. It's a little bit dated. We did a series when I was in California at the Institute for Biblical Counseling and Discipleship in cooperation with Ken Sandy's Peacemakers. He did a whole seminar. It's available from them as well as the Institute for Biblical Counseling and Discipleship. On how to suit-proof your congregation. In other words, what is the wise and prudent things to do in terms of screening workers for nursery, etc., the reporting issues, as well as the general liability issues of people getting hurt on the property. With the cultural zeitgeist that we're in now, people have no compulsion whatever of suing churches, which would have been unheard of 50 years ago. So prudence would dictate to sit with a lawyer, particularly maybe the guys at Peacemakers Ministry in Billings, Montana, as they try to teach congregations to be legally savvy and what to do to try to avoid those things. And there's so many details that, you know, you would need content like that. The other thing would be, I'm not suggesting this, but you could have a written covenant. And in our zeitgeist, again, people, especially in California, but elsewhere, are litigious, so they'll sue you at a drop of the hat. So even if you have a written statement, I mean, I won't go into that, but my wife ran a pro-life center that we had a form written up by a lawyer, and we ended up still getting sued and losing the case and to Planned Parenthood and having to shut the center down because we owed them over $200,000 in legal fees because we lost the case. So there's nothing that's perfect other than God's grace. I've been in churches that have been sued for $5 million. I've got those stories, too, if you want them. But that would be the best thing. And the second thing would be, whether it's a written covenant or in your membership class, you know, when people take that fourth vow for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, I don't know what numbers and say PCA, but you promise that in the Lord you will submit to the discipline of the church, and should you be found delinquent in doctrine or life, you will heed its discipline. That could include not going to the civil magistrate on a non-criminal matter.
Right.
You could say that as part of your church covenant when people come in to know this and have it set up. And if you're in a Presbyterian situation, then, of course, you have the appellate system, and you could write that right down, that if you think you have been, well, you wouldn't put in these terms, but, you know, ripped off, you know, you have the procedure that you can go to presbytery, you know, written right in it. So,
George, I had one more question. Jay, in the back of one of his books, Jay Adams has, I believe it's the, hold on one second. I think it's in Critical Stages of Biblical Counseling. He has an appendix in which he has a series of questions to go through with counselees, parishioners. And one of the things he says is to gather data. And I know that's one of the big first things that we're taught in biblical counseling is gather data. Find out how many people this individual or couple have been to, psychiatrists, psychologists, pastors. Mm-hmm. But he says, you know, find out what medication people are on. And I thought that was very wise, because if you have somebody on lithium and they don't tell you and they're acting crazy, you know, it's helpful to know they're on lithium. Well, I sort of brought this up in discussion with some people recently, and people in my church plant were very uncomfortable with the idea of giving information about medication they were on. What thoughts do you have about that? If somebody's reticent to do that, and yet that factors into the counsel that you give, and, you know, you can't be domineering, but what would you say if you had a large number of people in your church and they didn't want to give that information? Would you just let it go?
Yeah, well, I would certainly tell them, are you hiding something? You know, being on medication is not a shameful thing. You know, unless it's not prescribed or, you know, you're abusing it. You know, if you really believe that you have a physiological problem which has been appropriately and properly diagnosed and you are on the standard medication for that, you know, why is that a problem?
Mm.
You know, if you really guard your counseling and tell people, I am not going to tell anybody what is unnecessary. But again, right, in the context of one of you brought up before, what about discussing with the session? Your people need to know, look, I will tell you. I won't do it behind your back, but I'll tell you right to your face that, in fact, if, in fact, this is beyond my ability to handle, it will go to the elders. So they need to know, because I wrote an article a long time ago in the Journal of Pastoral Practice on the limits of confidentiality. Total confidentiality is not, I don't think, a biblical concept.
Mm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I said, I just don't think I can make that promise. I need them to know that I am not going to tell anything that's unnecessary, but right. If I think it is, then I'm going to tell them ahead of time, you know, that I'm bumping this up to the sessional level because I don't believe we're getting anywhere, and this is not a negotiable. This is an issue that has to be dealt with.
Mm. Right.
Right.
Connecting things back to the issue of being sued, there are issues in terms of confidentiality in which the pastor is required by law in some states to report certain things to the civil
yes.
magistrate, to the civil authority,
yes.
you know, if there is a molestation issue, those sorts of things. So it's a very difficult position to be in, but those who are doing counseling in the church need to be aware of those particular laws in whatever state they operate
yes.
in or whatever country they may be in, because you might be held liable for not reporting something. And
yes.
and
yes.
so even legally, complete confidentiality is not possible.
Right. That's only for Catholic priests.
Hey, George, is it wise to ask your congregants at the reception of new members after new members class if there's any criminal background? Because that seems like something we probably would be uncomfortable with, but, you know, you can't run a background check on all your people.
No, I think you do need to ask that. And if you find out that they've lied, that would be disciplinable. Just like
right.
if somebody lied before they got married and fraudulently entered into a marriage contract.
Right.
I think it is appropriate, you know, to ask that. We've run into that recently in the new National Association of Nuthetic Counselors. You know, we're found out through different sources that two people who had been certified had prior felonies.
Mm.
You know, and supposedly it does seem that they've changed and repented, but the bottom line is, especially, you know, if that becomes known, and it's a public matter, one of them was actually a sexual matter, then, you know, you've got a big issue of, whoa, you've got somebody on your list that's, you know,
yeah, felon.
Has
yeah.
this prior criminal record.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think it's appropriate to ask the people, you know, things we probably would ask. Are you still a member somewhere else? You know, do you have... It's be rare in these days. Do you have 27 memberships across the United States in different churches?
Right, right.
You know, because we're in such an age where people don't think that that's significant. They don't do it. Although some people will have connections. I had an illegal come across the border in San Diego, and I was thinking of even helping the person, you know, and certainly just giving him food. He went to the bathroom, and he had letters of recommendation for every denomination under the sun. You know, I came back and I go, you know, even though I know you're illegal, I might have helped you, but not because you're jerking me around. You know, you've got all these falsified things, you know, for Seventh-day Adventist, Baptist, Presbyterians, Roman Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just playing a shill game, and, you know, I'm not going to help you.
Yeah.
So people will try to bilk the church. And if you've been a pastor for more than a couple months, you know that probably some of us get "sucker lives here," you know, written on the doorposts, you know, in some
mm-hmm.
secret hobo language that they can figure out and try to get a free meal.
Right.
Yeah. And that also goes to show in counseling and in helping, even in diaconal ministry, you're not always going to make people happy and they're not always going to want the type of help you're offering them. People don't
you shouldn't make them happy.
Right.
Your goal is to make them holy, not happy.
Yes, exactly. And so people are going to be upset sometimes when you counsel or they're not going to like the advice you have or the suggestions you have and how they might change their life.
That's good. I should probably tell them that at the beginning. I do that with my classes now when I teach. I say, look, I want to say up front, I'm going to say something somewhere this quarter that offends somebody,
yeah.
if not everybody. So right. just get used to it and tell me when I do it. So,
right.
We become such man pleasers often in the parlance we say, you know, we have fear of man. And yep. and it's true that the counselor is not immune to that either. And even in our counseling, we want to find gratification, or we want people to say, oh, thank you so much. You've helped me so much. Well, a lot of counseling goes without recognition. And in fact, a lot of times you upset people. So it's really tough work.
Tell me.
Especially when you're not getting any paid.
I tell you the truth. I say, one of my jobs is to scare you.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my jobs, because they didn't do that when I was in seminary, they didn't tell me what it was really like out there. And I don't want you going out there. It's like somebody who's trained in the Army and, you know, they never get live rounds shot over them. You know, they think they're just in dress parade all the time. No, you could get killed in this. And I don't think it's fair for us to send young guys out in the pasture and get chewed up and spit out, you know, without realizing, you know, I don't want to be crass, but I have this saying, and it may sound like I'm cynical, but I'm really not. Sheep baa at one end, and they do something at the other end, and you have to clean up at both ends.
Yeah, you do.
that's the nature of being a shepherd, and if you don't want to do that, then you're just not going to make it in the pastorate.
Mm. Now, how do we actually get our young pastors and aspiring ministers to get some of that experience? What are some ways that they can go about doing that so they don't end up in a church? You know, perhaps somebody gets hired and they're the pastor of a church and they've never done any of this before, and somebody comes in with a case like your transvestite case or something like that. What in the world do you do? Or even an experienced pastor who gets, you know, he just gets sideswiped with something they've never even heard of or considered. Where is a pastor to go?
Well, that's what, now, don't laugh at me, but, you know, I'm a Presbyterian by conviction, not because I always seeing it work, but that's what older pastors and presbyteries are for instead of just arguing. You know, the bottom line is that you can't get experience except by getting experience or borrowing somebody else's experience. So one of the things is to be mentored by someone who does biblical counseling, because a lot of us are trained in preaching, you know, whether good, bad, or indifferent. We won't argue that, but we know what sermons are. We're told how to preach. But, you know, to take care of sheep and think that you can do it from the pulpit, this is about as crazy as thinking you can raise children in family worship. You may not neglect family worship and catechizing them and teaching them the word. But, you know, when they trip each other and fight with each other, you have to be able to sit them down and apply the word. And it's the same way with our sheep. And so most pastoral internships ought to include this, and people ought to make sure that they not only get an internship, but an internship with pastors who actually pastor their sheep. Secondly, if you're out and you're stuck, you can do what I've always done. You call three people that you respect the most. I did that my first pastorate. You'll smile at the result. A gal says, do I have to stay with my husband? He's not supporting me, etc. And it's one of those weird cases, and say, well, I said, I'm not sure. I'm going to call Jay Adams, John Bettler, and Wayne Mack.
Yeah.
So next time I saw her, she said, what did they say? I said, you won't be happy. She says, why? I said, I got three different answers.
Oh.
She says, well, if you guys can't figure out what I'm supposed to do biblically, how am I? I mean, it was complex, but that's what you do. You go to people that you know and respect, And you pass it by them, and you press them on points. And several of the conclusions that I've come to in the tough cases is because of, A, the experience that forced me to go back to Scripture, that came up with, you know, scriptural data, running it by people, and they giving me answers that just didn't make sense in the light of the little bit of data I had. You know, and so I'm doing the best I can, and I may well get to the point where I get to heaven someday and the Lord says, you know, Skip, you were wrong on that.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can with the scriptures to make these decisions. And I think it's much like the Old Testament law in a sense, you know, where Moses said, pick people that are filled with the Spirit. And here's the statutes. Right. They're filled with the Spirit and wisdom. They have to apply these to all the particular right. cases.
You know, it's interesting, too, right there at the beginning of Deuteronomy, one of the things that God says about the men that Moses was to pick, who would oversee, you know, help shepherd the people, was they were not to be intimidated by anyone because
right.
the judgment was the Lord's. And I thought that was a really interesting little nugget, because oftentimes, as Camden said, we are intimidated by people and we do fear
yeah.
man. But if we have God's word and we have his Spirit, you know, it's his judgment and he's the one ministering to people really through us, not us doing it.
Mm. Right. The other part, or the other flip side is that, of course, the stereotype of biblical counselors are they're biblical hitmen. You know, you just kind of whoop people upside the head with the Bible.
Yeah.
But there is a danger when we live in a sloppy age that has no theological precision and is ever being sucked into the emergent church mentality mm-hmm. that we can't be caustic Calvinists.
Right.
We must be compassionate and tender. And I think for myself, the older I get, the more I realize, you know, I ought to weep over my sins and other people's sins more than being angry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, being angry is yes, there's righteous anger, but it's rare that I'm that righteous. So I need the compassion, because otherwise, you know, the man of God, 2 Timothy 2, must be gentle, able to exhort those that contradict, so perhaps God gives him the gift of repentance to life.
Hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Now, in your situation, you have this wonderful institute there that's under the seminary, which is under the church. And for the pastors in the area, they would, I assume, be able to come with a counselee to your session and in a way be trained by watching how you would do counseling. Is that correct?
Yes. We have, at this point, we have on the master's level, in the Masters of Theological Studies and the MDiv, I don't want them to miss anything. So it's like I did originally at Westminster in California. You waive all your electives and you take them in biblical counseling. But
yeah.
you don't waive any of your core courses, language or otherwise, church history, systematic theology, exegesis,
right.
etc. So, yes, we have biblical content courses, an intro course, which is the basic structure, marriage and family, and then we have an advanced course. And then on top of that, we have what you would call field modules, observation of live counseling
right.
and discussion of that. And then role play, where people are videoed and staff will do the role play for us to get a feel where they are and what it's sort of like to do it. And then supervised counseling, where they do the live counseling and they're mentored one-on-one.
Wow.
So we do that, and we now have a D-Min at the seminary, and part of the D-Min emphasis in counseling is the certification process. It can be done from a distance. It's not ideal, but you know, if the National Association of Nuthetic Counselors, other ways of getting training from a distance does exist,
mm.
where people can mentor.
Those are all over the U.S., right, George? They have NANC counselors all over the country
yes,
that put on
it's
seminars.
It's still spotty, even after the 30 years. There's lots of concentrations because of who's been teaching, et cetera. Heavy in Indiana and in GARB circles because of Faith Baptist and you know, pockets here or there. So it's not uniform in every place across the country, as I would like to see it someday. But it's beginning to, you've got some graduate programs, you've got Westminster and CCEF, you've got, you know, and there's variations and all, but basically within the same ballpark. You've got Southern,
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Stuart Scott there
mm-hmm.
with Moeller. You've got an influence now down in Southwest even, where, Patterson's going on the line that he's for biblical counseling, not psychology. Huh. You've got the Masters. You know what I mean?
With Wayne Mack.
So,
right?
Yeah, Max, well, he's over, Mack, he's left there. He's over in as a missionary. He left when he was 70 to go be a missionary in South Africa.
Huh.
So he's my idol, you know, 70 years old. I haven't got there yet. So when I'm 70, I'm going to become a missionary.
There's a lot of opportunities to learn, and that's great. That's good news because we do need to be approaching counseling biblically. The Bible has much to say about it, and unfortunately, you know, in the mid-20th century, we kind of got steamrolled by a secular model.
Yeah. So. You know, I'm available. I mean, that's one of the things I love to do is to consult with pastors and kind of mentor them, you know, when they're in the midst of a situation. So, you know, there are things available.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Well, we hope to share some information and resources with our listeners. We can put a lot of links on the website and we can point people to the appropriate places. We've got a whole bunch of things going on. We're very excited. We're going to be broadcasting the Science and Faith Conference at Westminster Theological Seminary coming up March 12th and 13th. So keep your eyes on the website, reformedforum.org, for information about that as well as the live broadcast when it comes time. And you can find information for all of our other programs and subscribe to our podcast feed to get them downloaded automatically to your computer. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.